You're listening to another episode of Our Delaware Valley. I'm your host, Marcus Goldman. With me today is Joseph Woji. He is a professor of history at Rider University. He is also the owner and founder of Grim Philly here in Philadelphia, which is a tour group that gives you a chance to see the haunted side of Philadelphia, the macabre side of Philadelphia. And he is here to talk about the wonderful haunted aspects of Philadelphia and the area, because this area is a big, giant ghost story. Joseph, how are you?
Marcus, great to see you, man.
Great to see you again. It's been a while.
It has.
Since you've been in to talk about the Pirates and the New Jersey Devil, two very important historical parts of this area.
Yes. Prohibition as well, I think, the first time you had me on, we talked about.
That's right. Prohibition as well. Prohibition was crazy.
And so witches, ghosts, all kinds of matter of the undead
vampires.
For the season. We'll discuss all that.
And Philly's got a history with vampires as well, which will be fun to talk about, too. So we have a full-time vampire who you got to meet up with recently.
I did, and it wasn't Bram Stoker.
No, it was not. He was much taller than Bram Stoker.
Much taller, Jackie was.
Maybe even twice the size of Bram. Joe, give a background on yourself, how you started teaching this area, and what piqued your interest in why this aspect of history?
Well, I'm a professor of history at Rider University. I founded Grim Philly Twilight Tours, and we're all professors, R-rated sort of topics and subject matter. And when I was looking into things, I was like, man, history is awesome when it's presented in the right way. It's just that, rather than Ben Franklin flew a kite over here or Thomas Jefferson sneezed over there, it's much more interesting to look into the crazier, gritty, grim aspects of things. And I found myself gravitating to the ghost stories, the vampire lore, the witchcraft and things like that. And we get overlooked here because everybody, as you say, thinks of Salem. And, Philadelphia, we have a great, rich history of that stuff here.
Yes, and it'll be fun to talk about as well, because while, like you had said off mic, the founding fathers were working on the Constitution, witches were being dragged through the streets of Philadelphia, which is kind of a hypocrisy and kind of a goes against what they were fighting for.
And you would think that by this era of the Enlightenment, when you have Benjamin Franklin sitting in there and 55 of our greatest minds contemplating the Constitution and kind of hammering out the last compromises with that, it was the day James Madison arrived to town. So it was May 5th, 1787. They're dragging this poor woman through the streets. And the 8 Philadelphia newspapers at the time, it was the Philadelphia Patch kind of broke the story on this, but it was the illiterate peasants, basically, that kept this stuff up at a time where the courts and the learned, the judges and stuff like that, they weren't throwing sentences out, for witches at this point in time. But it's crazy to kind of wrap your mind around the fact that they were closer, the founding fathers, to this superstition era than to our era today.
That's insane to think about. It's really crazy to think about. Also, the fact that there were 8 Philly newspapers. I mean, seriously, think about that. 8 Philly newspapers. I mean, since I've been here, there have been 2 or 3. The Tribune.
Well, they
the
keep
Inquirer,
going out of business. Yeah, now.
And the Daily News. So it's just crazy that 8, and there were a lot less people in the area.
There totally was.
Yeah, like a lot less people.
There was more plagiarism as well. One would come out with the story. The other 7 would just regurgitate, just copy it.
How funny. So they would be fighting for the break, and then the other ones would copy.
Pretty much.
Yes. You also do the Grim Philly Tours, which we will talk about at some point as well, because it gives you a chance to see and feel the haunted aspect of Philadelphia. And I do want to touch about some of those tours and what you offer on those tours, but I do want to talk about the witchcraft, because you had said on May 5th, 1787, witch was being dragged through the streets as James Madison arrived in town, and it's kind of, I don't know, something about that just...
So it's crazy when you think about it, right? So what happened was, it was this German woman, they called her Korbmacher, which is basket maker in German. So the paper, all we have are the newspaper accounts of this. And so it doesn't give her actual name. They just call her Korbmacher. And she's from the Spring Garden section. She's a German speaking individual. They drag her down to the New Market, which we know as Head House Square now, right by South Street. And it was an English belief that we sort of adopt, that if you slash somebody's forehead open, it'll break the spells if they're hexing you. And this is what they do with her. She's dragged through the streets altogether three times. So all we have are the newspaper articles on this. One's in the Philadelphia Patch. They broke a story. One was the Philadelphia Herald. They broke a second story. But they drug her through the streets three times. She ultimately dies of her injuries, we think, from swimming. By swimming, what I mean is goes back to before King James, King James of the Bible. But he had sort of condoned it in his work, Demonology, which is to say that if you tie somebody's opposite hands or thumbs to their opposite feet or big toes, throw them in the water. So this would have been done at the Delaware. And if they sink, then the waters of baptism have accepted them. And so they're innocent. Of course, they're dead, but they're innocent. You know, consolation is you go to heaven. But, you know, if you float to the top, we have to kill you. And so probably this was done with Kolbermacher. And I can only think, like, well, where were they holding her? Obviously, it wasn't in a legitimate jail. You know, the jailhouse that we had at the time would have been, well, we had one on 3rd and Market Street. That was our first jailhouse. The second jailhouse would have been just recently built, and that would have been on 6th and Walnut Street, and it was called the Walnut Street Prison. So they wouldn't have held her in either one of those because these were official jailhouses. So I can only imagine, like where are these peasants even holding this woman? They weren't going to let her home, and okay, we're going to drag you through the streets, let you home, grab you again a second time, grab you again a third time. They were probably holding her someplace.
So she died from her injuries, but the thing that doesn't make sense is you can't have a religious right to kill somebody you think is a witch, and then if they drown, they're not a witch, and they go to heaven. That's kind of crappy. If you really think about it, if you break down just the basics of that.
Well, James's son, King James of the Bible again, his son, Charles I, when he gets into power, he does away with that. He makes that illegal. And James I was really the only guy, as far as an English king, to get involved in witchcraft trials, right? He was presiding over some trials in Berwick and kind of saw himself as a philosopher, wanted to investigate the witch stuff personally. So he was interrogating the witches himself. But you don't really have that after James. You have really, you know, his son sort of, you know, backs off of that stuff, but it gets a little crazier under his son because then there's like a civil war. And then the witch finder general, Matthew Hopkins, kind of goes, you know, his own way, but it's, you know, it's not really condoned by the state necessarily. It's a sort of self-given title that he gives himself, Witchfinder General, and he grabs like 300 people and interrogates them, you know, but he's got, you know, this sort of like local apparatus behind him. It's a grassroots sort of thing, you know, that kind of takes off. But that's the English kind of side of it, which we inherit.
We talk about, and in history, they teach us about the Salem witch trials and the importance of them. But here in Philadelphia, there was a lot more witchcraft tomfoolery going on, so to speak, and a lot more, I guess, trials and judgment. But why are the Salem witchcraft trials basked with such a historical importance when a lot of this stuff happened here in Philadelphia and in Baltimore and in D.C. and in New York that was really kind of ignored?
Well, if you look at Salem, right, you have 19 people are killed in Salem, 18 by hanging. So in the colonies, this is probably the biggest deal that we have here. I mean, well, God, you know, there were 30 slaves burned on Manhattan Island. That's by the Dutch, though. That's not by the English. The English over here, we don't actually burn anybody in the United States, at least in the English colonies. And so Salem is only, you know, it's hanging, and it's a lot. You know, 19 people are a lot. But when you, like, compare and contrast that to, like, the people on the Rhine, you know, on, like, the French side of the Rhine and especially the German side of the Rhine, you're looking at, like, God, like, 50,000 people are burned at the stake. 3,000 people at the Trier. A lot. Yeah. And there are different estimates, and that's probably about the accurate estimate. Maybe good 40,000 people in Germany alone. And so you got 3,000 people at the Trier Germany witch trials. And that's, it's a 3-year period of time that there are 3,000 people burned at the stake. I mean, that's massive. You know, we kind of see things as Americans like, hey, man, you know, like 19 people. Yeah, man, that's terrible. But when you look at what was going on in Germany, it was just like out of hand crazy. Crazy. And you can see a little bit of this stuff in like the Grimm Brothers fairy tales, the original sort of, you know, before Disney cleaned them up. You know, if you look at like Hansel and Gretel, you know, like they meet the witch, right?
That's,
you know,
cannibalism.
Yeah. And there's cannibalism because
in
the Malleus Maleficarum, that's this document by Dominican monk that says, you know, oh, we got to root witches out. And so they cannibalize Christian children and these sort of things. It's reflected in some of these fairy tales that Disney sort of, you know, they clean it up a little bit, you know. I mean, Sleeping Beauty, for example, you know, if you look at that, she's burned at the stake at the end. There's no happily ever after actually in the original version for her.
Whoa.
It's crazy stuff.
So she was a witch.
She was not a witch. She was she was burned at the stake by a jealous queen, basically.
Yeah. You mentioned the burning of 40,000 on the Rhine River between France and Germany. Was that happening at the same time over there as it was here, or was that like a century before and it finally made its way this way?
Well, as you said, yeah, it was beforehand. So as it's dying out in the old world, we still continue it in the new world.
Okay. With witchcraft, I mean, it seems like from what I've read, I don't know if you're familiar with the German author Oliver Potts, who does the Hangman's Daughter series.
No.
It's his family lineage are hangmen, and he writes stories from historical fiction based on that, and it's pretty fascinating. But in his stories, a lot of there's a woman who gets repeatedly accused as a witch, and she's basically an herbal medicine lady.
And that's exactly what, you know, it would be. You know, people were afraid. They thought if you had the power to heal, then you have the power to harm as well.
Yes. So there's always that yin and yang, the balance of harm and heal. Okay, that makes sense, but we've used this herbal medicine, the same herbal medicine for centuries, and that same herbal medicine and those same methods of healing that healed those people, they're now turning on those same people that healed them.
Well, the thing is that we generally, without a belief in magic, we wouldn't necessarily have had any witch hunts in the first place, because you wouldn't have bought into the fact that somebody could bend nature to their will. And so there was a wide belief in magic in pagan times. And so we would call these people wise men. Or cunning women or cunning folk, and we would usually seek them out. And the doctors were expensive, so you'd go to somebody that could say, you know, oh, you know, I could help you with your cold or with whatever ailment that you have. Pay me, I will create a charm for you. And this is a little bit threatening, I think, in the rural areas, especially with the church that tries, really, it's a lot of women that are doing this, and it's sort of a misogynist tendency of the church to sort of, you know, rein in the power to itself and to say that, you know, malficium, or, you know, like, you know, bad magic is what you have. Only good magic can be had by the church in the form of miracles. So there's good and there's bad magic, and we are the keepers of the good stuff. So, and it's really like a rural thing. But yeah, it was really a grassroots sort of thing where a lot of the witches that were being put on trial, it was necessarily the people that had misfortune befall them. Now, you may have somebody help you as a midwife, and that's a great, awesome thing. You know, you're witnessing a miracle. They're around to help, like the most happy day of your life. But what if your child dies, too? They're a part of the grief as well. So sometimes some of the women would be blamed for that, and they would be turned on. Sometimes.
Yes.
And there was a lot of emphasis, too, on curses. If you were cursed by somebody, they took it really seriously. A parent's curse or blessing, they took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. A beggar's curse, you know, they would take it seriously. And, you know, they would be reluctant not to give a little handout to somebody. And it didn't mean anything unless something happened later. If something happened later, then the beggar, if they'd cursed you, would be taken to court even.
Interesting. So it was a lot of unknown that maybe caused some of these superstitions.
And if Bill Nye the Science Guy was around, he could have cleared that right up. But this was an attempt in the days before, you know, Siri and Wikipedia and things like that to really kind of clarify the unknown. Like,
but we had Copernicus, and we had who's the gravity guy?
Well, I remember Copernicus. We got
Galileo. We have all those guys. They could have cleared it up for us.
You would think they cleared it up a little bit. But yeah, Copernicus didn't actually publish until about 6 months before he died. He had like one foot in the grave.
Wow.
He was reluctant because you got to figure Giordano Bruno got burned at the stake for saying, hey, man, there's probably other worlds out there. And then they were like, listen, man, you know, if they burned him at the stake. And then Galileo, they tried him. They sentenced him to death by burning. And they were like, listen, man, say you didn't know what you were talking about and you retract it and we'll just put you on house arrest for the rest of your life. And he was like, okay, yeah, man, I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, just don't lay me on fire, please.
And so they put him under house arrest.
Yeah.
And then he published his book.
Yeah. Well, we know what he said, yep. You know.
The whole witchcraft and the whole stereotype of the witch is fascinating because really, in a lot of ways, it's based on herbal medicine and natural, like using the earth and all of that. And like you said, the midwives, if a baby dies, they blame the midwife for a curse or for poisoning or for whatever. And just fascinating. And where did so we have these witch trials. Where did this whole concept of somebody being a witch and cursing start? How did this happen to where we got to the crazy level of burning people because we thought they were witches?
Well, it was the church really trying to assert power back to, you know, to itself. You've got to believe in magic since, you know, ancient days, really. The Greeks, when you go way back, you know, 3,000 years ago, they were trying to have, like, divination and necromancy. They were trying to contact the dead to see the future. People believed in this stuff, you know, going, you know, way back. And so it was a belief that pagan peoples had always held. And the church decided, you know, hey, we have to sort of usurp all of these practices and beliefs and have at least future generations sort of buy into the fact that this is a, you know, a Christian thing only. And the church doesn't really believe in necessarily like ghosts or anything like that, but demonic possession. I mean, the Catholic Church still condones it. It doesn't make a big deal of it. The other faiths really do not. Anglicans, for a short period of time, sort of tolerated a little bit of it with the exorcisms in England, and they were a big deal when people found out that there would be an exorcism. I mean, it was like, you know, a spectacular sort of thing. Everybody would want to gather around and watch it, actually, like as an entertainment sort of situation. But they slowly moved away from it, the Anglican Church, and it's really only the Catholic Church that continues with it. But it is not necessarily a medieval or older belief in, I guess, trying to root out witches, and it's more of an early modern phenomenon.
In some of the stuff that you had sent me, there were things like tests to determine whether people were witches, like the prayer test.
Well, if you stumbled over your words when you were reciting prayers, yeah, you were a goner. They would put witches with, you know, they would put them through these tests. And they did this at Salem. And some of it, if you think about it, I mean, it's almost silly, you know? They would look for marks. There were marks on a woman. They could be extra teats so that they would feed their familiar. You know, they'd have these little demon things that were running around. And they would feed, you know, they would nurse them. And so if they found those things, they were like, oh my God, there's some teats. Let's perform a prick test. And then they're like putting pins in them to see if they'll bleed. And if they don't bleed, oh, you're in trouble, because then it's, you know, the devil gave that to you in a secret location so that you could feed the, you know, your little devil baby. And, you know, you obviously got this because you had a little demon baby by having an orgy with demons out in the woods. You flew out there on a broom or a pitchfork on the Sabbath, the witch's Sabbath. And, you know, you had a lot of fun with the devil, and now you have a little devil baby.
That's so hilarious, because I think if everybody was invited to that orgy, most people would go. I mean, seriously, think about it. Everybody, oh, that orgy. Yeah, I wouldn't go. Yes, you would.
I think they have them in Salem now. I mean, not like the real deal, like, you know, hey, flying on pitchforks like in the air and having devil, you know, orgies. But they have a witch's Sabbath, I believe, in Salem for the 31st of October every year.
But like, here's also like the touch test, which some sort of energy spasm, like.
And it's almost rigged, right?
It's totally rigged against people. I mean, think about it.
Yeah, if I accuse you and then and then they have you touch me and then I flip out, it's proof that you've bewitched me, you've hexed me in some way. So it's almost rigged. And then the witch cakes, right? The barley
cakes,
they have their supposed familiars urinate or on these cakes, and or rather the familiars eat the cakes with the witch urine on it. And it's, I don't know, it's silly to modern standards, but people really believe this stuff back then.
Oh yeah, totally. By modern standards, it's absolutely silly, but yeah,
it's almost like children made these things up.
Oh my goodness, yes it is. Hey, do you want to give out a website or your social media information so people can get more information, follow along, and maybe learn a little bit more about witchcraft and the haunted aspect of the Philadelphia area?
Absolutely, man. GrimPhilly.com. Grim as in the Grim Reaper, 1M. Mm-hmm. GrimPhilly.com, 856-829-3100. And we do a witch tour, actually, here. And we go to the site of one of the witch trials, which you know about because we were talking off air on this. And Margaret Madison was the Swedish widow that they had put on trial the year after William Penn got here. And so it was crazy, right? Because she's Swedish. Yeah. So it's 1682, right? It's the year after he gets here. He's the judge. They put her on trial. And all of the peasants are like, man, she bewitched my cows. And this has happened at, it's on Arch Street, where the Arch Street meeting house is now. And the creepy part about it is, too, where the witchcraft trial happened, you got 18,500 bodies buried just on that block there in mass graves. It's the creepiest thing as it is. And then add to it that there was a witch trial there. How cool is that, in a way?
Yeah.
In a macabre Halloween sort of sense.
In a sort of grim way.
But all the peasants, man, they were like, oh my God, she bewitched my cows. I mean, think about it, right? Marcus, you know, I mean, if you had the power of, you know, witchcraft or you know, you were in the Legion of Doom, you know, what would you do with your power?
I wouldn't bewitch cows.
You kidding me? You wouldn't be like, oh my God, these people are going to be so sorry when I mess with these cows, you know? They'll never mess with me again. You know,
yeah, if I mess with their cows, they're not going to mess with me.
That's the thing to do. So she did. She messed with the cows, apparently. And William Penn goes, yo, baby, they say you're a witch. You fly on a broom. He said it just like that, too. But he asked her if she flew on a broom. And she's Swedish, man. She can't speak English. So he writes yes and no on a piece of paper. She picks yes. And she's on trial for witchcraft. She says she flies on a broom. So what do they do to her? Well, in the English world, we were a little bit more sensible. I don't want to say that we were completely sensible, like in modern standards. But he said, you're going to love this, too. He's totally cool about this. William Penn does not buy into the whole witch thing. CNN is not there. You are not there. I'm not there to sort of, you know, see the expressions on their faces. But he was probably like, oh, my God, she said she flies on a broom. Really? Are you kidding me? Oh, my God. You know, so he says it's not illegal to fly on a broom. Go home. He finds her guilty of the fame of a witch. She's guilty of people thinking she's a witch, in other words. She's not a witch. She's an old lady. Like, leave her alone. He sends her home. And, you know, she's still afraid for her life because all these English have put her on trial. It's a big, scary thing. So she flees, like, as far away as she can get over to, like, New Jersey. Jump forward a few years. Yeah. And they put her on trial for witchcraft again. And they hang her in Mount Holly, New Jersey, from the neck until she's dead, dead, dead. Mm. And years later, Benjamin Franklin writes about this years later in the Pennsylvania Gazette in a satirical piece. And he makes fun of it. And he says, oh, yeah, this poor old woman that you know, she made, and he makes fun of it. And he says, she made the sheep dance and the hogs sing. You know, of course, that wasn't what, you know, she was charged of.
Wow.
But he was making fun of it. Ben had a good sense of humor, if anything.
Yeah, this whole witchcraft thing is pretty amazing. And when you break it down and study it even more, I'm sure you're just like, how the hell? How could we do this? And we did it. But
it's entertainment for us, for Halloween now.
Yeah, for Halloween now, it is entertainment. But it's in some ways a dark, dark aspect of history. But
and this is where our ideas, our modern pop culture ideas, are informed by like the year 1600, give or take 10 years on either side. That's when the brunt of all of the witch trials were really happening. And our ideas, our modern conceptions of stuff, it's really formed then. Mm-hmm. You know, the flying on the brooms, as they said, over in Germany, at least. The English don't buy into the whole flying on brooms thing. They also don't buy into werewolves in England because the wolves were hunted to extinction. Yeah. So there were no wolves in England, so that's probably the reason why they didn't buy into that stuff.
But then you had the Hound of the Baskervilles in the 1800s, which could have been a wolf of some sort.
Well, isn't this the...
That's the Sherlock Holmes story.
Yeah, yeah. It's
and it could. They say it was a hound, but it was a big freaking hound eating a lot of people. But I'm glad that you mentioned the werewolves, because the French are big on lycanthropy, huge on it. There was in the 1990s, there was the French movie Brotherhood of the Wolf, which was about that. And it just seems that the Europeans are more big on that lycanthropy, the werewolf, the vampirism, and like that type of, and the Frankenstein thing.
Yeah, and it starts off in Eastern Europe, pretty much, like Bulgaria, Romania, and it works its way in through, like, Germany, you know, with a little bit of it comes over to America, too.
The werewolf stuff started in Eastern Europe?
Werewolves, the earliest mention of werewolves, actually, there's a couple of isolated instances. There is a real early case of it on one of the Greek islands that they said that the men could change into wolves and back again to defend the island, and at will they could change back and forth. In Germany, though, you had had some of the areas in Germany, they put people on trial. I think Peter Stump is the primary, most famous case of anybody that's been put on trial for it. But they said that he had some magical girdle given to him by Satan, of course, you know, and he could put that on and descend to hell and take orders from him. And he would cannibalize children, because that was what it was all about, cannibalizing Christian children, taking orders from the devil.
Very common story in those days. Very thematically common for the different lore.
And Satan was involved in the world. And it's sort of coincides with a lot of the areas that are Protestant for the most part. So it's like Protestant German areas and Huguenot areas in France as well. And so like along the Rhine on both sides, you had some burglars that would travel, some bandits on the French side of the Rhine that would try to disguise themselves as wolves and make it look like wolves killed people. You had that sort of going on too to try to cover things up. But again, you got a lot of this recorded in like 1812 by the Grimm brothers that it's earlier stories that they're actually recording. It's not like 1800 stories.
Some of those stories are thousands of years old.
Exactly.
But then, okay, so you have that, and then if we're talking about Europe and the lycanthropy and the vampirism and the witchcraft, then you can bring in the golem to that, which is another aspect of it. I mean, there's another one.
What's the golem?
Tell me. The golem of Prague?
Tell me.
The golem of Prague is a creature that was made of clay, the earth, and through magic was brought to life by the rabbis and the shtetls in Prague to protect them from the people killing the Jews. And then he went berserk and started killing everybody, so they had to put him down. And supposedly, the golem is lying in a synagogue in Prague. And when I was there in 1999 and they had all this golem stuff, I was talking to a Lubavitch rabbi outside the synagogue in Prague that I was at, and it was on... He was there, and I was like, so we were talking about the golem, and I was like, where's the golem? And he's like, he's up there. I'm like, take me to see him. And he's like, no. And so we kept talking about him. And I asked him three times, take me to see him. He said no each time. And then the fourth time I asked him, he said, my friend saw him, and it was never the same. And that's all he said, and he walked away. I'm like, that's
That's creepy.
That's creepy. So the golem, yeah, so you have all these stories that go with all of this, but I mean, I don't know how that the golem translate here, but in Europe you have, you know, the lycanthropy, you have that, but then you have like the New Jersey devil here, you have the witchcraft here. So I see where those historical ties come in from Europe, and it's pretty fascinating. But how did, like, I mean, I know we said earlier we were going to touch on vampirism. How did vampirism come over here? Because we associate vampirism with Vlad the Impaler.
The Ottomans.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire. Yes, the Ottoman Empire.
And that's what Bram Stoker, who lived in Philadelphia for a bit.
Yes.
And he lived in New York. He lived in Philadelphia. He did a bunch of research here as well as overseas. He was friends with a professor from Budapest. And so Bram Stoker really sort of uses Vlad the Impaler as a little bit of his... character for Dracula. And so he also takes the story and makes it a little bit different. I mean, you've had vampire stories going all the way back to Ambrosio. This, you know, 2,500 years ago, there was this Italian guy who goes to the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, falls in love with this hot girl, Selene, who Apollo likes too. Of course, Ambrosio gets her, and Apollo, being a god, curses him. So it's a curse. The whole vampire story and myth begins with that. And you've got also Lilith in the Old Testament, Adam's first wife, was supposed to have been a vampire as well. And so the stories have evolved. I mean, if you think about it, you know, I mean, Bram Stoker makes them change, and they've changed by the, you know, from Ambrosio to him. They're evolving, you know, like in front of our eyes today, right? Because now they go to high school and they glitter. They walk around in the daytime. They fall in love. They keep diaries. They date 16-year-old girls. They get feelings. They don't want to kill anybody anymore.
And they're sensitive.
And they're totally sensitive. They're like big teddy bears, you know, to fall in love with if you're 15. And they're 137, and it's fine. You know, it's okay. Yeah, it's
not because like, they're undead.
Yeah, they're
so
undead.
So time doesn't count.
Apparently not. You know, and they're teenage heartthrobs. But so by Bram Stoker's day, the Strogoi, as we call them, they were really like more soul suckers, energy suckers. And they would suck energy off of you, not your blood. Bram Stoker making them suck blood, it's taboo. It's sexual. It's sensual.
Yeah.
It was like over the top. Made him more famous is what it did, because people were writing these stories already before Bram Stoker, and it was a really popular genre, but he got more famous than everybody else, and we know him, we don't know them, because he changes it and makes it sexy.
So he was the one who brought the sucking of the blood aspect into it. Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's one of his geniuses to sort of make it a little bit more popular and sexy. So, but when people would basically, it was a medical condition that was going around, and it got a little bit spread around in the United States by Hessian soldiers, revived, at least I should say, by Hessian soldiers during our revolution, that, you know, they bought into this stuff. There's a big connection to with the undead to grave robbers. And if you look at, like, you know, when you dig corpses up, And the obvious reason that you would dig corpses up is to sell them to the medical community. Back in, like, say, 1700s, 1800s, you weren't allowed to acquire corpses. And the doctors today, you know, you need to use corpses. You need to practice on somebody. You don't want to go to a surgeon that says, well, hey, man, I never really tried that before, but it's on, like, page 372 in this book, and I have a chart here, you know. You'll be my first practice.
I'll open the book, you'll be my first.
Yeah. Let me find some old guy doctor that might have tried that once or twice before, you know. Nobody would ever get it in practice. So, essentially, when the grave robbers were digging these people up, they would see that they looked a little different sometimes if they overshot their window for freshness. They would have internal organs that would turn into brown sludge and start to come out of the mouth. They'd look a little bit like a vampire. They'd shrivel up. They'd start to look like they had fangs and teeth that were elongated because their gum lines receded. They'd look like they had claws because everything kind of recedes on them. So they looked like vampires. And then on top of that, they would see that people were, in reality, they were buried alive. They were buried prematurely with like a really faint pulse. But when they kind of came to, they'd freak out and start clawing the inside of the coffin. So the grave robbers were like, oh my God, you know, there's claw marks on the inside of this coffin. This guy was clearly dead when he was buried and then was not dead. He's the undead. And so obviously grave diggers and grave robbers, we'll call them ghouls, are not rocket scientists. They're not philosophers. They're ghouls. They're grave robbers. So they believe that these people were vampires. And so one of the things that Bram Stoker had in his notes was a little bit north of here from Exeter. And we've got a bunch of stuff, man, in the Rosenbach Museum at like 20th and Delancey on all of his notes that he had compiled. And he's got a lot of clippings from like the Philadelphia Bulletin on the Brown family in Exeter, that Mercy Brown is the American vampire, we call her. And so the whole Brown family in like 1882 was dug up. They had a big case of vampirism that had broken out in the village. And so think of this guy, George Brown. He's just lost his wife. He's lost all of his, you know, a whole bunch of family members. And they're like, dude, let's go dig up your wife, you know? And he's like, well, okay, let's go dig up my wife, I guess. Because they have to find the source vampire. So to find the source vampire, like in Bram Stoker's day, this is exactly when Bram Stoker is doing all his research, you've got to find the source vampire, and if you kill them, all of the minions will then go away. You know, it'll kill the minions, too. That's kind of where the story had evolved to. So they dig up his wife, Mary, and they cut her heart out, and there's no blood in her heart. So they're like, all right, well, it's not her, so we have to keep looking, you know? And the reason why we have to dig all these hearts out of the bodies is to make sure we got the right vampire. And they go dig up his eldest daughter, Mary Olive. They cut her heart out. No blood in her heart. So they're like, well, let's go dig up your other kid. So, you know, this poor guy. And the whole world back then, Marcus, by the way, it was all black and white. Everybody had a pitchfork and everybody had a torch, too. At least that's how I'm envisioning it. So in any case, they dig up Mercy Brown. They cut her heart out. And they're like, all right, you know, there's blood in her heart. So she's the vampire. And so they have to go through a ritual now where they burn the heart on the tombstone into an ash. They mix it in a frankincense and myrrh concoction with white wine. They go home and give it to little Edwin. He's the little brother suffering from vampirism. And you got to think about it like in a modern sense. Hey, man, we just dug up your dead sister. We cut her heart out and, you know,
burned it.
And here it is, man, in this concoction. He's like, I'm not drinking that. What are you kidding me? And, you know, they're like, we really went through a lot of trouble for this. You don't even know the half of it. Like, you got to drink this. And he does. He dies like 2 months later, you know, because he's got tuberculosis.
Yeah.
And the more I think enlightened people realize that we were just being buried prematurely. We're not vampires. We're not the undead. So, you know, there is no Strigoi. And what they do is make safety coffins. And after a death, you'll tie a twine to somebody's thumb or wrist, bring it out of a hole on the side of the coffin up through a pipe, tie it on the surface to a bell. And if you wake up dead or, you know, buried alive, you can ring the bell. And so you're saved by the bell. People could say you're a dead ringer.
Is that where the saved by the bell and dead ringer came?
That's where they came from.
Seriously?
And to be a guy
the
working
schoolroom class saved by the bell came from burying people alive during the tuberculosis.
Yes.
That's so rad.
It did absolutely come from that.
Yes.
A lot of funerary terminology comes from that that era, though, that wow. late Victorian sort of what we would say Gilded Age era in the United States here.
It also makes sense that we buried people with faint pulses that were undetectable because we didn't have the equipment or the technology maybe to hear some of those faint pulses. And we know that you can be alive on, we know through science that you can be alive on a faint pulse, like a barely, a teeny, 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 teeny pulse can keep you alive that's undetectable.
And they still find people in the third world. This still happens today. You know, where there's not,
I'm not surprised.
You know, where there's a lack of medical technology. Yeah. Where they don't have stuff like we do here.
Absolutely. In rural areas and in rural and tribal areas that aren't as advanced. Absolutely. Wow, that's fascinating. Excellent. Vampires, witches, undead. That's what I'm talking about. Joe, you want to give out your website, your information, so people can check out some of these Grim Philly tours as well as maybe do some research on their own if they like the macabre?
Absolutely, Marcus. Thanks, man. GrimPhilly.com. GrimPhilly, GrimPhilly.com, 856-829-3100. Yeah, we have witch tours. We have a vampire and witch tour. We have haunted pub crawls, serial killer tours. We run all year round. We do Christmas tours, kind of like Bad Santa stuff. And we do a Valentine magic, blood, sex, and magic tour, we call it. So,
oh, cool.
All year round, we have a lot of different adult oriented sort of topics.
And how long will these Halloween themed tours be going on for? Will they be going into November? Will they end at the end of October?
No, we go all the way through Thanksgiving with a lot of the stuff that we do, like just kind of intensively. Then we hit a sort of winter schedule where we're going to start our Christmas kind of tours.
Okay. And do you do tours every night of the week?
Every single night. Yeah. Yeah.
What times?
Twice a night. We do our witch tours at 6:30. 8:30, we do our vampire and ghost tour. And then on the weekends, we have the drinks and things like that. We throw like additional things at you.
Cool.
In the daytime, we do a cemetery and serial killer tour at like 10 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon. And then we do these haunted pub crawls that are super awesome, too. We have some drinks and then you get some ghost stories. And we hit a couple of haunted pubs.
Nice.
And you get a little light narration sort of at the end, you know, so you can drink and kind of socialize.
That's very cool. Now, do you have any tours that are kid friendly?
The witches and ghost tour at 6:30 every night. That is family friendly, that one there.
But the 8:30 tour, you said the one is more like friends and adults and dates and types of adult activities.
Vampires, sex, and ghosts. And
adults.
By the way, we're the only ghost tour Anthony Bourdain, you know, rest his soul, has ever actually taken.
Really?
Yeah. As far as, you know, our ratings go, we are the number one rated ghost tour in the United States, actually, on The Culturist. We're the number one rated ghost tour in Philadelphia on TripAdvisor. You know, we're all professors. We try to give you guys a good time. And so it's fun. You know, it's fun. It's educational, but it's definitely like out of the box, a little different.
And just so you know, when people like Joe, who are educators, are passionate about this, it makes teaching it and giving you the tour that much more fun for them as well, because they're just as passionate about teaching it to you as you are about going to experience it. And that's a win-win combo. I've done some of these tours in Philly and they're all a blast. This city is great. And being as old and historical as it is, you have to know that there's going to be some sort of badass haunted aspect to the city. There's no doubt about it. It's going to be there. That's what Grim Philly does. Is there anything else we need to know about as far as haunted Philly goes? Any other creepy facts or any other creepy moments that are Philadelphia related that you can discuss?
There's definitely a lot of hauntings here in Philadelphia, of course. The entire area that we go through is haunted. We've got, you know, different ghosts. Well, I mean, going all the way back to the Native Americans, even,
yes.
You know, I mean, even before we got here, right? Lenape had these beliefs in ghosts.
They had the shapeshifters back then.
Yeah.
Native Americans have been big on shapeshifters for thousands of years.
And believe that they would turn into wolves, as, among other things.
And you turn into your spirit animal in some tribes, so yeah.
Yeah, and they had a belief in witches, as well as in, the Lenni Lenape didn't. They believed in ghosts. A lot of the witch stories, though, from Native Americans was somebody would turn into that if they'd done something very heinous, like killed a child or something like that. And if you caught a witch practicing, you were allowed to kill them on the spot. That's sort of like with the Navajo, kind of, you know, with their their idea would come up with. But the Lenni Lenape right here, the Delaware Indian tribes, they believed, like the Romans sort of too, you know, you don't say somebody's name after dark because it will invoke their spirit to you, which will remind them of the fact that they're dead, and it sucks to be dead. And they'll attack you and try to get inside of you to possess you to get life through you. So you don't say their name after dark. And if you have to go out after dark, you try not to, but you bring with you some food and water, and you kind of drop it and run if you see a ghost, and it'll sidetrack them, and they'll want to maybe, you know, grab the food and water and
take a break.
Kind of like trick or treat in a way, you know? But when they disposed of their dead, they had to be disposed of properly. And the not properly disposing of a body would create a ghost or disturbing an Indian burial ground that would stir the spirit as well. You were also supposed to burn all of your hair and your fingernail clippings in your life because they said that you would be busy collecting them all as a ghost after you died. That's what the Lenni Lenape would say. But the ghost would last. There were like three stages. There was the initial stage, which would be like the soul ghost that would go away after maybe 4 days. They would finish their business up and then they would depart. After that, there was the blood ghost. That would be the second sort of phase. And then once the blood had dissipated into the earth, and it was a very important aspect of it, that would go away. And then that's the time that you're not supposed to say their name after dark, during that time where the blood ghost would still be around. The skeletal ghost, of course, would remain forever, and that's the ghost that you would stir if you were to disturb an Indian burial ground, which there were a lot disturbed, obviously, by, you know, European settlers when they get here.
Yep. And some of them have been haunted. Some of those burial grounds, you don't mess with the dead. That's something I sort of always believed in,
but there's
the haunted aspect of it.
There's been so many burial grounds in Philadelphia, other cities too, we're not the only one, that have been just removed, though. I mean, you got to figure, for one, of land and capitalism, you know, there's a burial ground and nobody is visiting it anymore, so the city will be like, oh, well, let's remove these graves and put some buildings up and we'll use this. Temple University did it with the city of Philadelphia in conjunction with them, next to the Betsy Ross Bridge. There was, I may pronounce it wrong, but Pierre Lachaise Cemetery, the very famous one in Paris.
Okay.
Where Jim Morrison's buried now, right? Well, before Jim Morrison was even born, we had a very large cemetery where the foot of the Betsy Ross Bridge is today, and it was removed. And I think about 30,000 burials were taken out of there. And I believe Temple University kept like some of the really cool stones, but the majority of them, they just dumped as breakbank, like right in the river on the Philadelphia side of the river. And at low tide, you can see about 40 tombstones come up out of the water. And it looks like they're rising. Obviously, the water's... The water's retreating around it, but it looks like they're rising up out of the water. But you can see them every day.
I wonder if people ever try to go get those out of the river.
It's a creepy thing.
Totally creepy. I'm going to have to go check that out now.
And they had renamed it Monument Cemetery because they had about a 40-foot-tall monument to George Washington put in there. At the end, but it was Pierre Lachaise at first. We were calling it, but it's only representative of like 100 other cemeteries that were removed.
That's so cool. That's really cool.
Every time we dig, we find stuff. I mean, just last March, not the March that passed, but a year and a half ago, they discovered what, like 77 fully intact coffins that were right next to the Ben Franklin Bridge, right on Ray Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a salvage mission. You know, Rutgers University came in, and the Mutter Museum, kind of in conjunction, they did it as a pair. They removed like 77 coffins there. And the construction company gave them like a week. They were like, hey, man, all right, yeah, we own this, but here you go. Get them out.
Yeah.
You don't have a lot of time for archaeological excavation like you would normally do. Just get them out, and then we'll continue with our construction. You have a week.
Wow. Haunted history. Philadelphia. Check it out. Is there anything else you want to put in, or is there anything else you want to share about haunted Philadelphia before we wrap it up, Joe?
Well, I think we got a lot here.
I think we did. We got two shows
today. I think we talked a good hour there. So
we did.
But yeah, just come check out one of the tours, man. They're really fun.
And learn about the haunted aspects of Philadelphia. It's very fascinating. There's some very cool aspects of that in Philadelphia. Joe, thank you very much for stopping by to talk about witches and vampires and ghosts.
You the man, Marcus. Thank you, sir.
You bet. You're listening to another episode of Our Delaware Valley. I'm your host, Marcus Goldman. If you would like more information about Grim Philly, Haunted Philadelphia, the rich history of witchcraft, vampirism, lycanthropy, any of that haunted aspect, ghosts of Philadelphia, email me, marcusgoldman@bbgi.com. Thank you again for listening. Enjoy your Sunday.